From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how the Farrelly brothers got to make such crude, adolescent, and incredibly funny movies. They wrote and directed Dumb and Dumber, Kingpin, and There's Something About Mary. We'll hear their onstage interview, recorded at the New York Comedy Film Festival. Then we'll hear from an advice columnist who could have helped many of the characters in the Farrelly's movies, Dan Savage. His sex advice column, Savage Love, runs in weekly papers around the country. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. A former prosecutor and one former Republican ex-governor went before the House Judiciary Committee this morning. They said President Clinton's conduct would probably not result in prosecution and should not lead to impeachment. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
A few of today's witnesses prefaced their remarks by saying, "I'm no Tom Sullivan." Thomas Sullivan is a former U.S. attorney with over 40 years' experience in criminal trials. He noted that he was once asked to indict a member of Ronald Reagan's cabinet. He declined, saying the case was doubtful. After reviewing the evidence against President Clinton, he reached the same conclusion.
This case would simply not be given serious consideration for prosecution. It wouldn't get in the door. It would be declined out of hand.
But politicians are not prosecutors, and Republicans on the panel appear to remain committed to approving at least one article of impeachment later this week. Former Massachusetts Governor William Weld proposed an alternative punishment that could include a censure, a written admission of wrongdoing by the president, and perhaps a fine. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
Committee Chairman Henry Hyde today signaled that he may allow the committee to consider a vote to censure the president as well as a vote on articles of impeachment. Hyde told reporters today he thinks it's fair to allow such a vote. Republican Congressman John Porter said today mail and phone calls from constituents leave him undecided on whether to vote in favor of impeaching President Clinton. Last month, Porter said he would oppose impeachment should the question reach the floor of the House. That puts Porter at odds with fellow Republican Amo Houghton. Writing in today's New York Times, Houghton promises to vote against impeachment, preferring what he calls a strong statement of rebuke. Britain's Home Secretary Jack Straw ruled today that extradition proceedings against former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet should go ahead. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
Jack Straw's decision comes 2 weeks after Britain's House of Lords ruled that Pinochet had no immunity from a Spanish extradition request. Spain wants to try the dictator on charges of murder, torture, and genocide. Since the Lords' decision, Straw has been listening to arguments from both sides about whether to allow the extradition process to continue. As Home Secretary, he had the final discretionary power to halt the proceedings and allow Pinochet to leave Britain on compassionate grounds. Straw decided instead to issue an authority to proceed. Pinochet must now appear at Bow Street Magistrates Court in central London on Friday afternoon as the extradition process gets underway. It's expected his lawyers will seek to delay that appearance by applying to a higher court for a judicial review of the Straw decision. Michael Goldfarb, NPR News, London.
The Food and Drug Administration today approved the first oral therapy for hepatitis B, a drug already used to fight AIDS. The Glaxo Welcome drug 3TC helps protect against liver damage caused by chronic hepatitis B. 3TC cannot cure hepatitis B, which infects an estimated 1 million Americans and can cause cirrhosis or liver cancer. You're listening to NPR News. In NPR's business updates, stocks opened higher today, but the market has been moving in a fairly narrow range for much of the morning. Most of the attention of investors is again being focused on mergers, though this time, they're going on overseas. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The biggest merger of the day does not involve American companies. Instead, it combines two of Europe's largest drug makers. Zeneca Group, Britain's third biggest drug company, has agreed to buy Astra, a pharmaceutical maker based in Sweden, in a stock swap deal valued at roughly $35 billion. The new company, to be called AstraZeneca, will be headquartered in London. Also moving the markets today, news that TWA has placed orders for 125 new jetliners with European airplane builder Airbus and U.S. manufacturer Boeing. The combined orders are worth nearly $4 billion. The airline has also taken options to order 125 additional planes. On the economic front, the government announced today the nation's trade gap set a record for the fourth straight quarter, rising to $64.4 billion for the third quarter. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Chicago Teamsters working for UPS walked off their jobs today in a dispute over job assignments. The union says UPS supervisors are performing work that should go to union workers, and that robs them of overtime opportunities. The Teamsters local says about 11,000 workers are involved. Local says members have set up picket lines at UPS facilities throughout the Chicago area. Leaders of six Gulf Arab states have ended a three-day summit with a pledge to extend oil cuts agreed in June until the end of the year. At the same time, the Gulf Cooperation Council urged other oil producers to take similar steps to, quote, achieve market stability for the benefit of both consumers and producers. I'm Frank Stasio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Farrelly Brothers' jokes are cheap, adolescent, and crude, and they get the whole country laughing. Peter and Bobby Farrelly wrote and directed Dumb and Dumber, Kingpin, and There's Something About Mary. In There's Something About Mary, Ben Stiller starred as a nerd who since high school has been obsessed with pretty and perky Mary. Ready to confess his love, Stiller hires a private detective, played by Matt Dillon, to track her down. But the detective falls in love with Mary and wants her for himself, so in his report to Stiller, he lies and creates a very unappealing portrait of Mary.
Got some excellent news for you, my friend.
Oh, yeah? Excellent?
I think your life's about to change.
Really? So you found her?
Oh, yeah. And you were right, man. She really is something else.
Oh, my God. Really? So she hasn't changed at all, huh?
Well, that I couldn't say. Let me ask you something. Was Mary a little big-boned back in high school?
Big-boned? No, not at all, no.
I guess she packed on a few pounds over the years.
Oh, yeah? So she's a little chubby?
Oh, I'd say about a deuce and a half. Not bad.
Oh, my, a deuce and a half, huh?
You know, a bunch of kids, and you're bound to put on a few pounds.
Oh, so she's married?
No, she's never been. That's the good news.
Huh?
Yeah. Four kids, three different guys, but no rock. Tough to keep up with in a wheelchair, I bet.
Oh, she's in a wheelchair? Mary's in a wheelchair?
We recorded the Farrelly brothers talking about their movies at the New York Comedy Film Festival in October. They were interviewed on stage by their old friend Michael Corenti, who directed Federal Hill and is directing a movie written by Bobby Farrelly called Outside Providence.
I guess the first question is, everybody's dying to know, is were you guys just regular knuckleheads as kids? Where, I mean, did comedy just happen, or were you like the class clowns in school, or?
Well, we were special.
You were special?
Yeah.
Yes.
I guess. No, actually, we were very, very normal kids. We were both you know, poor students, and, you know, we played sports and, you know, just fooled around, that kind of stuff. And it wasn't until our mid-20s that we got the bug to write, and it was, I don't know where the bug came from. We were not kids that watched a lot of movies. We didn't have a movie theater in our town except for 2 years. And we weren't, you know, running around with the Super 8s, and, you know, we were just normal people who went to movies, and we walked out a lot of times and thought, that just sucked, you know? I mean, why didn't they do this or that? We'd sit around and talk about it with our sisters or, parents, you know, friends. Like, do you see that, you know, the ending? Wouldn't you think it would have been better if this happened? And finally, in our mid-20s, just sort of having failed in a lot of different departments, and, you know, school and jobs and this type of thing, we thought, let's just try that. You know, what the hell?
How about your inspirations, your filmmakers that have inspired you guys?
We didn't really grow up watching movies. Don't know, and like even to this day, people say, "Oh, geez, you must really be big fans of Preston Sturges or Billy Wilder." And I don't even know their movies. You know, like which ones they are. I really don't.
Wow.
We didn't study any of them. If anything, we like grew up watching the Three Stooges on television, but mainly just what made us laugh in real life. And we weren't the class clowns. We weren't the guys that were going making up funny stuff. But we'd come home at night at the dinner table and say, oh, man, this kid in class today, you know, he tricked this girl. He said, hey, you see the frog? I brought my pet frog with me, you know. And the girl would look, and he'd pull the head of his hog out of his pants.
Like, which was painted green, by the
yeah,
way.
Yeah, right, painted exactly. Green. Yeah. Like, how's that not funny?
Yeah. That's brilliant, yeah.
We just remembered that kind of stuff and put it in the movies.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody has that kind of stuff. But, you know, a lot we make fun of our ability to direct because, you know, really, you know, we had never directed a commercial video. We hadn't gone to film school before we directed Dumb and Dumber, and it made a lot of money. So we're like, well, it's a scam. You know, I mean, we didn't know anything about directing, literally nothing, you know. And The thing is, they didn't question it at New Line because we'd written this script, and Jim Carrey read the script, and he said, yeah, I'll make that. And then we had been trying to get movies made for years, and we'd gotten stars attached before, but we couldn't get directors. And then by the time we got the directors, we couldn't get the star was busy, so it had always fallen apart. So at that point, our agent, Richard Lovett, had just said, well, why don't you just say you're directing? We're like, oh, okay. So they said, who's directing? We're like, we are. And amazingly, no one questioned this. You know, they were like, okay. So we ended up directing it. It worked out.
To this day, we know, to add to that, we know absolutely nothing about lenses. I mean, you don't know what a 30 or 40, 80, whatever the hell numbers they're talking about. You don't know what they are, do you?
No idea.
No idea either. Absolutely do not know. We let them being the director of photography and our technicians on the set it up like you think that we want it. And... occasionally we say, no, yeah, you're wrong. That's not how we want it. It needs to be a little faster or getting closer. It's not, you know, very broad generalizations, but we let the guys on the crew do everything that they do, and we just concentrate on the story and directing the actors into getting a good performance and getting a take and make sure that we feel we're moving on with a good take at every juncture.
Could you talk a little bit about how you guys actually got into it, how your first film got made, what the process was, and where Jim Carrey was? And
well,
it was part of what Pete was saying was that we really wanted to, you know, we just thought we had gone a long time without getting a movie made. We got an actor attached or a director, but we could never get both. And finally, the agent said, attach yourself as directors and just make up your mind you're going to get the movie made. So we picked the script Dumb and Dumber, which we had written and had been, you know, turned down a number of years ago, and said, this is a movie. We can direct this. It's pretty simple. And we just said, you know, made up our mind that we'd probably do it and go right to video. Like, all we wanted to raise was like $500,000, or, you know, if we could raise $1 million, that was a home run. And that's a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money to make a movie. Well, anyway, we went and we met with all sorts of people. We met with the Pettis brothers in Washington and everyone in town. And finally, we met with MPCA in L.A. is this company, straight-to-video company. And they said, all right, we'll give you $1 million to make it. And by the luck of the draw, our agent, Charlie Wessler, got it to Jim Carrey, who was...
Producer Charlie.
Yeah, right, I'm sorry. All right, producer Charlie Wessler got it to Jim Carrey, who was like weeks away from breaking out. And he said, I love this. I want to do it. And right, you know, basically right then, his career started taking off. And the fact that he was going to do it, New Line came in and said, we'll give you, you know, a little more money. We'll give you, like, you can make it for $3 million or something. Well, Jim Carrey, he had already made Ace Ventura, and he had already made The Mask, but neither one had been released. They were in the can. And he felt like, I've done good work. I, you know, he felt proud of it. And he said, I want $1 million to make this movie. That was his asking price. He had made $400,000 to make The Mask at New Line, and they owned that movie. And they said, no, $1 million? No way. It was right then that Ace Ventura, we went to see Ace Ventura in front of they showed it to us in front of a room full of kids. And do you want to know, the people at the studio were running from that movie. They thought, this is the worst movie that was ever made. And I will not in any way have my name attached to it. Well, we saw it in front of, you know, with a room full of kids, and the kids were laughing their heads off, and we thought, this guy's really funny, you know. And we called the guys at New Line and said, you ought to give him the $1 million. You really ought to. This guy's, he's pretty good. They said, leave the business to us. The movie came out, was a big hit opening weekend, a surprise hit. At which point everyone came back, that's my movie, you know, I love that, I always loved it. And by, they said, they called on Monday afternoon, we'll give you $1 million. He said, no. By then he wanted like $2 million. No, I'm not giving you two. I'll give you, you know, then they started over. Well, long story short, 2 weeks later, New Line signed him to do our movie for $7 million. Because he had just been auctioned around. Everybody wanted a piece of him. And then all of a sudden the movie, you know, because they're giving him seven, our budget went up to 16. We got a lot more money to shoot it. We got more time. We got more days. We got better locations. And you know, they gave us $60 million, which was, you know, so for us, it was a lot of, you know, luck just being the right place.
And somehow, during this whole period, they failed to, again, ask, like, well, what have you directed? Like, they kind of forgotten about us because
nobody ever asked.
No, they never asked. It just never asked. And in fact, we had a backup plan. I'd called a friend of mine who was at UCLA Film School. I said, yeah, can you get me a reel or something in case they ask? I'll show them something. But they never did.
It got to the point where the night before or 2 days before they were ready to make this movie, what happened, Pete?
Well, the night before, we finally, we went up to, we started shooting in Breckenridge, Colorado, which is at 9,600 feet. It's very high. And it was, I couldn't breathe up there. You know, the altitude with the pressure of, you know, what is going on here? You know, we're going to direct a major motion picture. And we don't know what the hell we're doing. And I just had a panic attack of panic attacks. You know, I was like curled up on a bed, just like, you know, blubbering. And Bobby was like saying, just calm down. Just, we've gone this far. Just calm down. I was like, no, you don't get it. We don't know what we're doing. Are you a moron? How do we show up? When do we yell action? You tell me when. There's like nine things said before that. You know, speed lights. Is, when do we yell it? So we called David Zucker, who we'd written a script for before, and, you know, he wasn't, you know, he's no, you know, brain surgeon either, and he'd made a movie. So we called him, and we were like, David, how the hell, what do we have to know? You know, he was from Milwaukee. He came out and made a movie. He hadn't gone to film school. He says, you don't have to know anything, but you got to be honest with everybody. He says, it's, if you know the story and you know what you want and you trust the guys around you and you don't try to be Mr. Know-It-All, it'll work out. But you have to tell them. He's like, he said, you got to tell, the first thing you got to do is you got to get the DP and tell him. I said, what's the DP? He's like, director of photography. I was like, yeah, what's that? He's like, you know, the main camera guy. And then he said, and get the first AD. He's like, I don't know what that is. He's like, the guy's like been running things, yelling at people. Okay. And we basically got them and we were honest with them and told them and say, listen, we don't know what the hell we're doing. We're salesmen. This is, you know, we're lost here. And they kind of, you know, walked us through it. The first day, I remember, the first AD would, you know, yell like, you know, speed, this, that, and then he'd point to us and we'd, action! And we were off to the races.
We're listening to the Farrelly brothers who wrote and directed Dumb and Dumber and There's Something About Mary. They were interviewed by filmmaker Michael Corenti at the New York Comedy Film Festival. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the Farrelly brothers who made the films Dumb and Dumber, Kingpin, and There's Something About Mary. They were interviewed by fellow filmmaker Michael Corenti at the New York Comedy Film Festival.
When all of these comedies, when so many comedies out there are put on the screen and fail, what do you think it is about the pictures that you guys make that succeed? You've had three very successful films when there have been so many, I mean, scores of comedies. To have three films work as well as they have in a row, what do you think it is that separates the stuff you guys do from these other comedies?
Well, you know, our feeling is, and you know, not in, and by the way, you know, there's a million good comedy writers out there, and, you know, we read scripts a lot of times that are very, very funny, but they don't work as movies because, you know, people think when we start a movie, we're sitting down like, how can we beat that? You know, what can we do that's more gross? You know, And that isn't how we approach it. The first thing we do is we think, how can we make a character so likable that you could get away with murder? And that's what we do. We have to set up a guy. Like, even in Dumb and Dumber, the most important scene in that movie to us is before they go on the trip to look for Mary, you know, Jim's in his apartment. He's looking out the window, and he says, you know, I don't have anything. I don't have anyone. And he actually worked up a little tear in his eye. And when the studio saw that, they said, what is that? That's a comedy. Get rid of that. And we're like, no, you can't get rid of that. That's crucial. Because in the very next scene, he's selling a dead bird to a blind kid in a wheelchair. You're like, if you don't love this guy, it's over at that point. They're going to hate him. So they kept fighting us. Finally, they said, listen, please do us a favor. Just test it. Test it without that scene. Like, okay, we'll test it. So we did a test screen. It came out. And you could just feel it in the audience. They didn't like these guys, and they were just creepy, you know? And I remember we came out in the lobby afterwards. We felt like, oh, thank God. Because we were afraid for some reason it would go well. We really wanted that scene in. And it didn't go well, but the guys came walking out. They said, that was the best screening yet! And we were looking like, you got to be kidding. And they were like, no, it's the best. But luckily the scores came in. They dropped 20 points. And they allowed us to put it back. Well, that's how we start everything. Like Ben Stiller, you know, if you don't love Ben Stiller in this movie, in the first 20 minutes, and we went out of our way to make sure you did, then at the end, when he has the thing on his ear, man, that is not going to be funny. That's just going to be gross. And so that is how we approach it. And I think a lot of movies don't. Like, my favorite comedies do. Like, I love the movie Tommy Boy. I thought that was a great, great comedy. And the reason it is because you really cared about Farley in that movie. He was a likable, you know, schlump. And he had a couple of moments where he talked about his dad, or you know, he got a little misty, and you cared about him, as opposed to a lot of these comedies, which is just if you don't like the guy, they just come across mean spirited, as would ours if we hadn't taken the time to set him up.
Yeah, and to that, I would like to add that with a comedy, and probably with every movie, but we've only done comedy so far. You know, you go and you test the movie. The studio takes it and they show it to a 500 or 600 people in some town in New Jersey or out in Sherman Oaks, California. And then they make everyone fill out cards and telling you what, you know, asking what they like and what they don't like about the movie. And to me, that's like the most predictable thing in the world is that, beyond that, then they keep 20 people in a focus group at the end of everyone else leaves and they keep the 20 people and they sit up there in the front of the room and they ask them, what did you like? What didn't you like? How was the music? How was this? How was that? And within those 20 people, there's like two or three people, it's the dynamics of any group that like to hear themselves talk. They get up, they have a lot to say. It doesn't make them great movie makers. But if that kid says, he should get the girl at the end, and there's 8 studio heads back there, well, you're going to have a hell of a time fighting them that your hero doesn't get the girl at the end. And so what it comes down to is there's some 13-year-old kid in the Valley who's calling the shot on every movie coming out of Hollywood. And fortunately with Pete and I, is like, I really do think because it was two of us that, and we were stubborn enough, was like, no, they don't get that. You won't believe how many times they tried to get us at the end of Dumb and Dumber to get that the two guys, you know, make out with two girls and that's a happy end, you know. And so finally, when we did the thing at the end where the bikini girls come up and all that, and it was the big issue was the guys have to get on the bus, you know. I was like, they're dumb and they're dumber. They don't get on the bus. They never would. They never will. We'd be selling out if they get on the bus. The kid in the front said he wanted them to get on the bus. I was like, no, he doesn't get on the bus. And I don't know how we
so you're saying the kid's wrong. You're like, you heard him. Why would he lie? You know, you're like, he's not lying. It's just it's programmed into him to want that. Like how many people want him to get on the bus? The whole place. Everybody lifts their arm. Yeah, it's happy. That's nice, but that's not what we do. And now today, people approach like, thank God they didn't get on that bus. You know, that would have been horrible.
Okay, one last question. What is it about Rhode Island that we all think is so funny?
Every time I tell Rhode Island stories, rather than laughing, people just feel, I get a look of horror. Because it is a twisted place. You know, it's a great place. I mean, I love it. You know, we're from there, we had a great time. But I don't know, it's something about, maybe it's everywhere. You know, maybe it's not just Rhode Island, but that's all we're writing about. But we happen to have, I remember when our friends were leaving, this is like one of those, it's to us is like one of those stories stuck with us. It's a horrifying story, but our best friend was moving to South Carolina, you know, in 1970, and the whole family was going. The father got a transfer. It was very sad, and the kids were pissed about going. They were about to start high school, a couple of them, and nobody wanted to go, but, you know, the father got the transfer, and they had a dog, Tippy, who was like, you know, this was back in the days when, you know, dogs ran everywhere. You know, you see him like, oh, there's Tippy. He'd be 3 miles from home, you know, just be running down the street. Oh, there he goes, you know. You'd be playing football and like a pack of dogs would come through. Okay, hold on, wait up. You know, the dogs would be, and then go on. You know, they've got things to do. And Tippy, the kids felt that it would be not fair to take Tippy, who was, I think, 8 or 9 at the time, to South Carolina because he had so much freedom there. And they were discussing whether to give him to the neighbors or to take him. Half the kids wanted to take him, half wanted to give him to the neighbor. And they started screaming back and forth. There were 4 or 5 kids. And while they were doing this, all of a sudden they heard a gunshot, and they went out back, and the father had shot Tippy. And he said,
I'll fix
the argument's
little.
Over.
Exactly. That's Rhode Island.
And that's Rhode Island to me. It's like, it's very odd.
We're listening to the Farrelly brothers, who wrote and directed Dumb and Dumber and There's Something About Mary. They were interviewed by Michael Corenti at the New York Comedy Film Festival. We'll hear more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Jonathan Richman with a title song from There's Something About Mary.
His friends would say, stop whining, they've had enough of that. His friends would say, stop pining, there's other girls to look at. They've tried to set him up with Tiffany and Indigo, but there's something about Mary that they don't know. Mary, there's just something about Mary. Well, his friends say, look, life's no fairy tale, that he should have some fun, he's suffered long enough. Well, they may know about domestic and imported ale, but they don't know a thing about love. Well, his friends would say he's dreaming and living in the past, but they've never fallen in love, so his friends need not be asked. His friends would say, be reasonable. His friends would say, let go. But there's something about Mary that they don't know. Mary, there's just something about Mary.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, why the Farrelly brothers don't write subtle humor, and sex advice columnist Dan Savage tells us what it's like to be a gay man offering advice to gay and straight men and women.
Sooner or later, she feels the morning come. Isn't it safer? Dark thoughts all gone. What a sensation. She has made one more tomorrow. Raising up her eyes to a brand new sky. She knows the truth at last. She's never coming back. She'll be gone.
So baby.
She'll be gone. She'll be gone.
This is the
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of Peter and Bobby Farrelly, the duo that wrote and directed Dumb and Dumber, Kingpin, and There's Something About Mary. We recorded them in October at the New York Comedy Film Festival, where they were interviewed on stage by filmmaker Michael Corenti. In the question and answer period, someone in the audience asked about the Farrelly's brand of humor.
Subtle humor to us is like, not funny. we like to go all the way for it. Like, we feel like, I'll give you an example. David Zucker sent me a script about a year ago, and it was called Toddlers, which is going to get made. It hasn't been made yet. And the idea is these two guys, they crash land in somewhere in the Himalayas, and it's a valley of giants. And in that valley, there's all tall people, and they hate short people. They kill them as soon as they get anywhere near there. They realize this early on, so they shave their body hair, and they wrap themselves in blankets and drop themselves off in an orphanage. And they are toddlers. And, you know, they, to protect themselves. And they start liking it because the nurses come in every day and give them a bath. And the nurses, like, scrub them, like, oh, you're a big boy, you know? And they really look forward to it. And one day the nurses come in, they're like, hey, they throw off their clothes, like, you know, here's a bath, you know? And the nurse pulls him into the other room, and there's some religious figure there with a knife or scissors, and there's going to be what you think is a circumcision. And they're like, no, they're trying to run away, and they yank him over, and the scissors come down, and they cut the hair of each, a little lock of hair. It's a tradition in the tall people world. And I read the script. I called David. I said, David, that's the 80s. That's like you're saying, like, oh, I thought. Well, the way we do it is, like, I say circumcise them. Circumcise them and have them limping around for 10 minutes in the movie and let it get infected. Go further. Like, let something worse happen than that. That's how they always did movies in the 80s. Like, oh, I thought he was going to end up sleeping with his mother. No, sleep with your mother by mistake. You know, go there. Go all the way. And, like, the subtleties are lost on us.
No, but what we do, you know, maybe we're dead wrong. What we think we do is that what's subtle is that, like, in Something About Mary, there is a romantic comedy and there's a love story. Like, that's subtle. Is it, and in a way, it's kind of camouflaged by these big gags that everyone else talks about. But take those away and there's another movie, you know. And so I consider that subtle, that's in there too. And that's what makes the gags work better. If there was no other story, if there was no other layer to it, the jokes wouldn't work as well.
Another question from the audience was about the Farrelly's working methods. Their interviewer and fellow film director Michael Corenti spoke first.
Well, I grew up in the construction business. I get up at 4:30 or 5 o'clock every morning. They don't. So I was sitting on the edge of my bed the first day we started writing, like 5 o'clock, 6:30. I figured I'll give them till 7:30, 8 o'clock. About 1:30, Pete gets up and goes, time for lunch. I say, lunch? Okay. I'm trying to be nice. So we eat lunch. Bobby comes over. They read the paper. Now it's about 2:30. 2:30 in the afternoon. I'm sitting there scratching my head. Bobby says, so, you ready? I say, yeah, I'm ready. So we write for about an hour. Pete says, God, I'm exhausted. I got to take a walk. So we take a walk. Put the Andy Griffith comes on at 4. We got to watch that. About 6:30, Pete says, well, that was a great day, don't you think?
You know, there was a Seinfeld episode where they try to write their sitcom. I don't know if you remember, but where they're basically sitting on the couch reading. And, you know, that was the funniest one to us because it is so true. We really... when we start a script, we'll take a week or two. We'll not even make an effort. We'll just be reading and talking and getting all the crap out of the way that you do. And then finally, somebody's like, "This is, you know, this is embarrassing." Like, he has to go home, he has to face his kids. You know, like, "Daddy, you need to work." You know, we're sitting there in our underwear watching the Masters or something. You know, so. Eventually, we get down to it, and once we do get down to it, we work pretty hard for about.
20 minutes.
No, we'll never. I mean, we work. We never really work. I don't think we work often more than 4 hours a day. I mean, actually writing, because you know, at that point, that's a lot of time to write. You know, it's. Don't you think?
Well, I have to say, when I write by myself, and I write from the crack of dawn until 6 or 7 at night, but the fact of the matter is, you get about 4 hours of good work a day, regardless of whether you sit there and beat yourself over the head for 12 hours. You really get about 4 hours of work a day. They just, and I learned a lot about writing working with these guys. I learned a lot about patience. I learned a lot about not forcing the joke. That you really do have to take the time to let it develop, or you have material, comedy-wise, that's forced, and it ends up looking like that.
Yeah, and another thing that we do, by the way, talking about that, is like, occasionally someone will have an idea that, you know, if you expect an idea to be funny right off the bat, forget it. It doesn't happen. Like, and a lot of people dismiss it, and nah, that's not, and we don't. We say, like, someone has something, we say, well, wait a second, hold on now, wait. Don't lock that out. Wait a second. There's something there. Mm-hmm. And we toss it around and look in every angle, and, you know, 4 to 5 times, there isn't anything there. It's like, okay, that didn't go anywhere. But we'll look. We'll milk it. We'll mine it. You go in, look all the ways around. Is there a way to come back? And then, you know, because people expect it just to be funny right away, and it's not. It's about timing, and, you know, it's very complicated.
It's work. It's not as easy. I mean, we joke and laugh. We sit around and watch the TV, but it's work. That kind of comedy. Yeah,
and when you're sitting
easy.
Around joking and watching the TV, it's generally because you're not quite sure what you're supposed to be doing, you know, and that needs time to be thought through and get right. Once it's right, then we can bang out a bunch of pages in a row, but it doesn't even make sense if you don't have it to just get the pages down, just to get them down. Like, I mean, we force ourselves to get pages down, but it's okay to sit around and just talk about things. Generally, there's a reason why you're not writing is because you need to think it through more. Which is also why in the world of comedy, it's almost a total necessity that you write with a partner. It may not be so in other genres, but in comedy, you need two guys egging each other on and bringing each other further. I think rare is the person that can go find those places by
Woody
himself.
Woody Allen, Neil Allen.
Yeah,
Neil
I know. They did do it for sure, but those guys are like, you know, legends.
The Farrelly brothers recorded at the New York Comedy Film Festival, where they were interviewed by their old friend and fellow film director Michael Corenti. Our recording engineer was Leszek Wojciech. Our thanks to the festival staff and its executive producer, Mark Isaacman. Someone whose advice could have helped a lot of the Farrelly brothers' characters, sex columnist Dan Savage. This is Fresh Air. When Dan Savage is asked about his professional qualifications as a sex advice columnist, he admits that he has none, but it's not like he lied his way into his job. A friend who was starting a weekly newspaper asked Savage what kind of advice column he thought the paper needed. Savage replied, sex, since people would risk anything to get their hands on a publication that covered sex. They agreed it should be different from other sex columns. It should be written by a man, by someone young, and gay. Savage fit the description. He wrote a prototype and then was surprised to find he had the job. His column, which is carried in weeklies across the country now, is called Savage Love. That's also the title of his new book, which is a collection of his columns. We're going to have an adult talk, which you may find inappropriate for children. Do you think, judging from the letters that you get from your readers, do you think that straight people and gay people see sex differently in any fundamental way? I don't mean in terms of like the mechanics of it, but just...
I think men and women see sex in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
I think gay men are men, and lesbians are women, and straight men and straight women are men and women. And when you have two gay men together, you get sort of male sexual dynamics cubed. And when you have two women together, you get female sexual dynamics cubed. Camille Paglia did some interesting writing about it in Sexual Persona, and I think she was right on the money. I think there are different hardwired genetic differences, different attitudes towards sex. We look at, when you look at the sexual behavior patterns of every other vertebrate mammal on the planet, practically, and there are repeated sort of dynamics in the male and female of all these different species, how we can look at all that and say, well, that doesn't apply to us, is beyond me. I think it does apply to us, and it plays out in same-sex relationships in sort of a almost a comically exaggerated manner. In a lot of opposite-sex relationships, female sexuality acts as a check on male sexuality. And in gay-sex relationships, for gay people, sometimes that female check is absent. And it can run riot. And it can be problematic in the lives of gay people. It's not the business of straight people to worry about it, but it can cause problems for gay men. And I address that honestly in my column. And then you see the same thing on the other side with too much reserve, I think, in some lesbian relationships.
You write that the idea some heterosexuals have that sex should be natural makes for some confusing thoughts. What do you mean there?
Straight people think that they shouldn't have to talk about sex to have sex. That since straight sex is obvious, you got tab A and you got slot B and you know exactly what to do, that there shouldn't have to be any conversation about likes and dislikes and preferences and anything else. And gay people don't have that attitude, because when you've got a tab or a slot and a slot, you have to have a conversation about what's going to happen. A lot of straight communication about sex ends with consent. Both people agree, and then sex happens, and there's no discussion because it's natural, and there shouldn't have to be a discussion. And that negatively impacts, I think, the quality of heterosexual sex a lot. With gay sex, once you say yes, that's the beginning. Once there's consent, then you talk about what you like, what he likes, or what she likes and she likes, and it's a long, drawn-out conversation so that you can find a way to sexually gratify each other that isn't, you know, dictated or wasn't taught to you in a high school sex ed class. And that takes communication, and straight people can sometimes skip the communication stage or skip communication entirely. Because straight sex is vaginal intercourse, what is there to talk about?
What are some of the things that you think people confess to you as a sex advice columnist that they wouldn't tell other people?
Anonymity is a powerful drug.
Yeah.
And people don't have to sign their letters to me, and I will answer them, and I'll put them in the paper. And there are things that I think that straight people can admit to me because of anonymity, and also because I'm a gay person. And whether they consciously or subconsciously realize it, I think a lot of straight people intuit that if I've given myself permission to be gay in this culture, if I've given myself permission to come out, and then I'm probably well positioned to give them permission to do whatever it is they want to do. You know, you see a lot more sexual expression in the gay community around fetish and kink and out there sexual practices and fun stuff that's not hurting anybody. Because, you know, if you've given yourself, as a boy, if you've given yourself permission to kiss boys, turning around and giving yourself permission to get a spanking isn't so scary. But for a straight person, you know, who never reached a point of conflict around sexual identity, that spanking is the scariest thing in the world because they never had to climb the mountain of, you know, rejecting an imposed sexual orientation. That's a lot of my mail, you know. May I? I call it my mother may I mail, and I put it in my mother may I file. Where, you know, I want to dress up like the Queen of England and smear peanut butter on my butt and get a spanking. What should I do? And my answer is invariably, dress up like the Queen of England, smear peanut butter on your butt and get a spanking. Who cares? It doesn't hurt anybody except for you, and you want it, so it's not really a hurt, is it? Permission is what half of my mail is. I'm granting absolution and permission. I feel a lot like a priest sometimes.
Now, what have you found some of the most typical sexual insecurities are?
Jumping back a little bit, am I normal? Is this normal? And invariably, it's people with abnormal desire that want to be reassured that it is normal. And people have to let go of that. And that's something that gay people let go of early, you know, in teenagers. That's when I let go of being normal. And straight people sometimes have, you know, what makes straight people better than gay people is that straight people are normal. So the straight person who is confronted with desires that are regarded by their friends or family as abnormal sometimes has a little identity crisis on their hands. And, you know, half, that's the other half of my mail. You know, half of it's mother may I, and the other half is this normal? They want some reassurance that it's okay.
Well, apparently, judging from your mail, a lot of people have these powerful sexual fantasies that involve some kind of abuse, like being spanked or, you know, some kind of sadomasochistic imagery that they're not at all comfortable with. They're not sure whether they should give in to the fantasy or fight it. I'm wondering if you've given a lot of thought to why so many people's sexual fantasies have to do with some kind of risk or pain or sense of, you know, degradation?
Because it's sexy. I don't know. Risk is sexy. And a large part of often what makes sex erotic is this feeling of risk, whether
but,
you're
but
just
why
risking
do you think
being
that's
vulnerable.
True? I mean, you're just saying that as if, well, we all know that that's true. Why do you think that that's maybe true?
God, no one's ever quite asked me the question that way. I don't know why it's true, and I don't think maybe that... I wonder what value there is in questioning it, you know what I mean? These things turn me on, and I want to know why, but once you know why, what difference does it make? There's still going to be
I'll
the things that turn you on.
I'll answer that, because I think this is particularly true for women. You know, at the same time that people are being much more open about their sexual fantasies, you know, you also have the women's movement, and women have, you know, really stood up and say that they refuse to be degraded by men or in a sexually degrading relationship. And at the same time, if they're having a fantasy that...
But it's not sexually degrading if you're play-acting, if you're pretending to be degraded.
At the very least, it could be confusing for somebody.
It can be confusing from the outside. It's not. I don't know anyone who engages in SM practices who's confused by it. I know people standing outside of it who may not understand it and feel at once titillated and repulsed can sometimes be confused by it because of what it looks like. But when you watch little kids play... You know, I always compare a grown-up S&M to cops and robbers and cowboys and Indians. It is play. I mean, I think there's a reason why folks in the leather SM fetish community, which is just a horrible thing to say, it sounds so unsexy to say that. There's a reason why they call what they do, they call it play. And play is exciting, and it's fun, and it's these roles. And I don't think you can divorce power from sex. And I think it was one of the mistakes of the sort of the feminist movement in the early 80s, especially the lesbian feminist movement, was trying to strip power dynamics out of sex. Power makes sex sexy, and power is always there. Whether, you know, you're just rolling over on top of your partner forcefully, there's like this erotically charged expression of power in that, or if you're taking the power roles and exaggerating them with props and costumes and cages and masks and whatever, and then inhabiting them in this like ridiculously blown up performance. Even then, it's still. I think it's the same thing as, you know, a back scratch or a playful slap and tickle. It's just blown up, and I don't think you can divorce power from and pain from human sexuality. Look at the role that power and pain plays in the sexuality of lower animals, and you see it all over the place. You know,
you do. Handcuffs.
The boy animals
and leather.
Not the handcuffs, but you'll see the boy animals beating up the boy animals for the right to mate with the girl animals. So it's not just a human thing where you see power and violence in humans in sexuality. It's just present, and we can't run away from it. Better we should we should approach it in a healthy way, which is to compartmentalize it. You know, the problem is when power dynamics are unspoken, or when they're unspoken, they can become abuse, or they can, you know. I would rather have my boyfriend slap me during sex for fun than slap me during an argument. And I think sometimes it's the same impulse that can cause the slap.
Do you think that sadomasochism has been entering the mainstream? In other words, that it's much less underground and practiced by many more people than...
Yes, I do. Uh-huh. I mean, there are these... there's in the state that I live in, there's these chain of sex shops, like for non-shameful sex shops for grown-ups. And you can buy restraints and handcuffs and stuff and little paddles and blindfolds. And certainly SM imagery has become much more mainstream. It was on LA Law like 8 years ago, somebody was handcuffed to a bed. I mean, imagine that 20 years ago on television. The Republic would have collapsed. And I certainly think that people recognize that, what's important is consent. Did you see the movie Thelma and Louise a few years ago?
Mm-hmm.
I had a big argument with a friend because if you remember the rape of Gina Davis in this one scene where she was put up on the hood of a car and raped, and then yay for Susan Sarandon came and shot the guy. Woohoo, that should happen every time someone's raped. And then later in the movie, Gina Davis had consensual sex with Brad Pitt, with Brad Pitt's character, and it looked the same. Brad Pitt's character, Gina Davis, was up on a dresser, but it was like the same position. It was the same sex, basically. And my friend thought that was terrible because it was referencing the earlier rape. It was... You know, it was just like the rape. It wasn't beautiful. It wasn't bunnies and in a bed and rose petals and crap like that. But I thought it was a really powerful statement about what's important is consent. She wanted to have sex with Brad Pitt. Who wouldn't? She didn't want to have sex with that guy on the truck. So it didn't matter that it looked the same. What mattered was consent, and her character had consented.
My guest is Dan Savage. He writes the nationally syndicated sex advice column, Savage Love. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Dan Savage, and he has a syndicated sex advice column called Savage Love, and Savage Love is also the name of his new book. You are from a Catholic background and went to a Catholic high school. I'm wondering if it was difficult for you to start writing about sex, writing very explicitly about sex in your column. If maybe you were very inhibited and had to get over that.
I was very inhibited when I was young, because of my Catholic upbringing, I think. And then when I came out to my family, I sort of injected a conversation about sex into our family life that has, in my immediate family, that has been healthy. And so by the time I started writing the column, many years later, it was I was used to having these sort of blunt conversations about sex with people I was related to. My family is not from the quiet, passive-aggressive Catholic tradition. We're from the loud, argumentative, let's-have-a-drink Catholic tradition. So when I came out, it did initiate this like ongoing debate about human sexuality, and relatives would come to me and say, so what do you do in bed? How do you do that? You know, I went from feeling, guilty and shameful to being really aggressive about saying, this is how I do it, this is how it's done, and you get out of my face about it, or I'll give you more gory details. And it was a sort of a self-defense mechanism to be that graphic, you know. You think you can shame me by implying that I have that kind of sex? Well, let me tell you, this is how it works, and this is how it feels, and I dig it. Get out of my face. I would have those conversations with my uncles, you know, who were, when I first came out, who were pretty homophobic, you know, and now are totally over it. I think, you know, my personal experience of interacting with my large extended Catholic family around my sexuality is that straight people are fascinated by gay sexuality. They want to know how we do it. And if we don't tell them, they make stuff up about gerbils. So we should tell them, and we should answer their questions. A lot of gay people react in horror when somebody says, so what do you do in bed? How do you, you know, isn't that gross? You know, won't that hurt you? Doesn't it hurt? And gay people, you know, get all offended and puffed up and say, you know, I'm not just who I have sex with. I don't want to just be a sex. But then we don't answer straight people's most sort of burning questions about what makes us different. And I was always doing that with my family. So when I started writing the column and started writing about straight sex and the way straight people did it, it was sort of a natural extension of this 10-year-long conversation I'd had with my family.
Now, is it true that your family was in an archdiocese film about model Catholic life?
Yes. My family was in featured in a special that the Chicago Catholic Television Network did in the 70s. My dad was a Chicago cop, a homicide detective, who had never met a gay person before I came out who wasn't a murderer or a corpse. And he was a Catholic cop, and he was a Roman Catholic deacon in the first class of the permanent diaconate, which was this sort of priest shortage stopgap measure the church began engaging in about 20 years ago to get somebody up on the altar. And my mother was a lay minister, and I was in a seminary, and we were all confirmed, and we were the perfect Catholic family. And, you know, now a few abortions, a couple of divorces, and a gay son later, we're not the perfect Catholic family anymore, you know. And they, but they haven't contacted us about doing a Where Are They Now special, and I doubt that they will.
Sex is, it goes without saying, a very sexy subject. I wonder if you ever get tired writing about it.
I do, actually. And sometimes in the column, I will change the subject and write about something else. I've written movie reviews in the column, and sometimes I just write goofy nonsense in the column. Because
you have a headache?
Because I have a headache, exactly. Sometimes you just, yeah, you got to change the subject. I do a lot of other writing. I do pieces on This American Life on public radio, and I do a lot of writing for my home paper in Seattle, The Stranger, on politics and just stuff that has nothing to do with sex or gay sex or anything else. Or gay politics. And that other writing, I think, helps to keep me sane. People say, oh, you're sexually obsessed. You write this column. And I always say, well, it's a sex column, so of course I would appear to be sexually obsessed if all you ever read is my sex column. But, you know, I have long conversations into the night with my friends about Kosovo and NAFTA, but no one's there to see them, and I don't write a Balkans advice column. I write a sex advice column.
Well, Dan Savage, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Dan Savage writes the nationally syndicated sex advice column, Savage Love. His columns are collected in his new book, Savage Love. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Roberta Shurrock, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Research assistance from Sam Adams. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown and Company, publisher of Holiday on Ice by NPR commentator David Sedaris, available in paperback in bookstores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.